All right, we're on Daf Kuf Chaf Hey. Chaf Hey Amid Aleph. And if you recall, yesterday we were discussing Masachi Fakuvia, who's Pasuli Eidus, either because he's Eino Osek Bishuv Shel Olam, or alternatively because he is guilty of Kain Gzela. And the reason for that is because Asmachta Lo Kanya. So we had a whole discussion about that. And then we had yesterday a story, if you like stories, about somebody by the name of Bar Benitus, and there were two witnesses, and we finally got this straight yesterday. The first witness said that I saw him extend a loan with Rivis. And the second witness says he lent me money by Rivis. Which means that the second aide, according to his own admission, is the lover who violated the Isur of Rivis, because Isur of Rivis applies not just to the Malva, but also to the lover and the borrower as well. And to our surprise, Rava accepted both witnesses, put them together, and he passed Bar Benitus as a Malva Beribis. And the question is obvious: how can we accept that second testimony when the witness himself, by his own admission, is Posulianus? Because, as we said, according to Rava, not only is the Malva Posulianus, but even the Lova is Posulianus. So he's telling us, in front of Bezdin, that he borrowed money Beribis. So here's where Rava introduces the principle that we've seen before. This is not for the first time, but he invokes the principle of Ein Adam Mesim Atzma Rasha, that a person is not capable of testifying against himself. He's a Karav Etzel Atzma. So therefore, although he's believed to testify against Bar Benitus, that Bar Benitus in fact lent money Beribis, but he's not believed on the part of that story that he himself was the lover who borrowed the money Beribis. Now before we start the next sugya, Hahu Tabocha, let's make the following comment. The Ravid is very famous for saying the following, that there are two participants in every Eidus. There are the players on the stage, so to speak, that's called the Osei Dovar, and then there are the witnesses, the spectators, who are the Makayme Dovar. And there's no overlap between the two. You can't sit on both sides. You're either on the stage or you're in the audience. And in this case, where he's testifying about himself, that he borrowed money Beribis, he's on stage. He's being Osei Dover. And that's not Eidus. You can't classify that as testimony when he is on the stage. He's describing his own activities. You can only gain the status of a witness if you're the Mekayme Dover, if you're testifying as a spectator about somebody else other than yourself. When you testify about your own self, that's not called testimony at all. And the Ravid says that there's no shame aid. It's interesting that the Ravid would have said that 7 or 8 centuries before Reb Chaim Brisker. You know, you would expect that Reb Chaim was the first one to talk about a shame aid. But it's actually the Ravid who talks about a shame aid. And the Ravid, based on this distinction, wants to justify the halacha of nimtza echad em karav u'pasul, meaning if you witness the crime because you were the victim of the crime, then you are pasul yedus. And if that be the case, then no edim could ever testify on that crime because you're part of the group of witnesses, and you're pasul. And then we should apply the principle of Nimsa Echemem Karav Apostol, that if one of the three members of the Kat is disqualified, that he, one rotten apple spoils the bunch, and he completely torpedoes and disqualifies the entire Kat. So the Ravid's answer is that although he as a victim saw and witnessed the crime, but nevertheless he is not mimakaimi dover, he doesn't have a shame aid. He is osei dover, he's somebody who's part of the activity, and therefore he's not part of the kat. It's not like the case of an aid who's possible, who was a witness and a spectator. Here he's not an aid at all. And if we apply that here to our Gemara of Rava, with regard to the second witness who said that Barbatinus lent me money, I borrowed money from him, Berimis, then when he adds that statement that I was the one who borrowed the money, that statement is not part of Aedus. It doesn't have a shame Aedus to it, because what he testifies about himself is Osei Dover, not Makaimi Dover. Okay. So now let's start the new sugya for today. Hahu Tabcha. Adafchav Hey of an Aleph. Can you think of any simonim that would help us locate Hahu Tabcha? Yes, no, maybe? What is it?
It's really right in the middle.
Right smack in the middle. What's the first word of
Russia.
The law?
Russia.
Russia?
But it's two Russias.
Well, it's the second one.
Yeah.
It's one two further down.
The second Russia. Okay. We'd like to talk about the Rishayim, especially when you get two of them together in one place. Russia, can I throw this bag on the side here?
It's not mine.
My bag? Okay, good. And this we'll put here. Okay. So now we're going to hear a sad story about a Tabach. And this guy is actually selling non-kosher meat in the Jewish marketplace.
Never.
Right? And we hope that never would happen, but unfortunately it happened at the time of the Gemara, and it still goes on today. Yeah, recently, and there's scandals here and scandals there. My father was once, unfortunately, involved with a couple of tabachim back in Maine, which is his first shtel as Rabbanus, and there were shochtim there that were feeding and selling people non-kosher food, treifa meat. Anyway, dishtakach means shchiach means to find something, or to be something that exists. And we found the nafka, that what came out Mitusei Yodi from under his hands was treifasa. Treifasa means an animal that's treif. For example, let's say an animal has a puncture to one of its internal vital organs. Then the animal is treif. You're not allowed to eat its meat.
Did the butcher himself do his own inspection, or was it?
Correct. He had to do the inspection. In other words, not only does he do the shechita, but he also has to do the bedika. That's called a shochet ubodek. If you know anyone with the last name Shub, I don't know if you've ever heard that name. I know people that come from the Shub family. And it means that their ancestors were shochet ubodek. And if you learn Hilcha Shechita, you'll see that Rashi Tevis Shub all over the place. You know, every other line is a Shub. A Shub is a Shochet Ubodek, which means he shechts and then he checks the animal. He's the one who's personally and exclusively responsible to decide whether that animal and the meat of that animal should be marketed as kosher meat. And in this particular case, they discovered that the Shub, who's called here a Tabach, shechted the animal. It was a treifa animal, and he sold it out in the marketplace. He was making a really good living, so to speak, if you call that living. He wasn't living in a spiritual sense, but he was getting very wealthy, because everything that he shechted, he sold for a profit, and people were eating his treif. So who found out about this? Rav Nachman. And Pasle. Pasle means he disqualified him for testimony. Now, we had a discussion yesterday about who's possibly Aedus. So we came to the conclusion that anyone who is willing to take money or to profit from a violation of an Avera, then he might actually perjure himself in Aedus in order to make money. Somebody is paying him off, and we cannot trust his testimony. He's called a Rasha de Chamas, In other words, for the love of money, which is called chevdas mamon, he's willing to do anything, no matter what violation he has to violate. So we're not talking about a person who's tam, he's not religious. You know, he's a rasha and he violates the whole Torah. He's a, you know, if you offer him two pieces of meat to eat, you tell him this one's kosher and this one's non-kosher, and they both cost the same thing, he'll eat the non-kosher meat. He's a rebellious person. He wants to show that he doesn't. Such a person is a rasha. But we're talking about a person who, if all things are equal, he would eat kosher meat. But for the love of money, he's willing to violate the Torah. That's called a Rasha de Chamas. Chamas means he gains money. The Abre means they would no longer accept his Shechita. They disqualified him. And now the question that the Gemara is going to address is, can this person, or how can this person, do tshuva? He wants to sincerely repent and he wants to be reinstated. Azal, Rabbe Mazye Vitarfe. Now this is really interesting. This butcher, in order to publicly demonstrate that he was that he's doing tshuva, he started growing his hair and his nails very long. This is what's called nivul. So if you're writing notes here, you would probably want to write the word nivul, and then I get an extra salary for teaching ulpan, because the word nivul is a modern Hebrew word as well, but it's a halachic term. So write it down. It's nun yud vav lamed. And if you'll ever nebuch learn the laws of avelus or the laws of nidui and many, many different sugyas in Moed Katan, you'll have to know about Nivul. The Ramban wrote an entire essay in his famous collection anthology called Toras HaAdam on this concept of Nivul. When a person wants to indicate how depressed he is, and he's blaming himself for his mistakes and his failures, and now he wants to rectify these failures, that he puts himself into a state of nivul. Nivul means to be totally unkempt. You know, a normal person will shave, he'll cut his nails, and he'll cut his hair, and this person is menavel himself. And all this is part of a public display of tshuva. Rashi, actually, Dibra Maskel Rabbi, mentions this concept of tsar and avelus. When a person is in avelus, he's never depressed. The last thing he thinks about, again, if he's Jewish, is to take care of his presentation. You know, this is not the moment in life when you start beautifying your hair. I mean, maybe Yosef HaTzadik was a little bit guilty that he was beautifying himself while his father was in Avelus. But certainly the Avel himself is not going to be miskashet u misyapeh. He's not going to look beautiful. And my Rebbe used to always quote a case of a famous family in Massachusetts, probably if not the most famous American family of all American history, that it's up there in the top five. And when she lost her husband, who was killed in a motorcade, you may know who I'm referring to. So the newscast said what she did before the funeral, and how she beautified herself, and she bought the most fancy outfit, and so forth and so on, and she showed up at her husband's funeral, and Rav Soloveitchik used to point that out, even though he was a great patriot and he lived in Massachusetts, but he would point that out as an example of the difference between genuine avelus and what in the goyim is considered acceptable practice and behavior. But in any event, this person, this tabach, shows up in front of Rav Nachman as a nazuf. Nazuf means nazifa. He's in a state of nivul. He's grown his hair. He looks pretty awful. His nails are long. He looks like a person who's been excommunicated. He's in a state of nidui. And this was all self-imposed. And the question is he genuine or is he not? So Rav Nachman is he's a believer in man. I don't want to use the word naive because that might sound pejorative. But some Rav Nachman lach shorei. Rav Nachman said, "Look, the man is doing tshuva, and he demonstrates that with his nivul, the fact that he looks so unkempt, like a person." In New York City, we have a certain area, I don't want to mention it, in Manhattan, where that's where all these bums hang out. It starts with a B, but it's not bum. Mm-hmm. And that's where you'll see people who haven't taken a shave or a haircut in who knows how long.
It's all over now in New York. It's not just that.
Oh, it's okay. So hopefully it's not in...
It's not.
In the Lower East Side. The Asians are, you won't usually see this. The Asians are very clean and very very kempt and so forth and so on. But I'm a lay Rava. So Rava turns to Nachman and he says, "Aren't you being a little bit naive? Dilma, perhaps, irube kabarin. The man has been selling non-kosher meat. He was machshil the rabbim, and now you're telling me because he grew his hair long, we're going to be machshir him. We're going to again reinstate him as the tabach. I think you're going too far. It could be that his tshuva is only klapi chutz. It's only on the outside. He's trying to demonstrate and fool us." And this is all just a show, but he's not really genuinely a Baal Tshuva. He's just fooling us. He wants us to think that he did Tshuva, but we don't really have any proof. Now, basically, what Rav is saying is that although the normal principle in halacha is innocent until proven guilty, every person has a cheskes kashrus, here we have a chazaka to the opposite, a negative chazaka. He has a cheskes psul. He's an avarion, he's a sinner who has been machshil. He caused the downfall of so many people who ate from his meat, and it was non-kosher meat. And therefore, he has to prove himself in a very positive, convincing way that we're absolutely certain, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that instead of this cheskas paslus that he has as a rasha, that he now has gone to the other extreme and he has a cheskas tshuva. That he was chozer b'tshuva, and we don't know. He hasn't gone far enough, because whatever he did could be just be a fake. It could be a facade. Elamata kante. So now Rav has to ask the following question: are we saying that a person cannot do anything to prove to us beyond the shadow of a doubt that he's a genuine Baal Tshuva? There's got to be a takana. There's got to be some way that this tamach, for all that he did, and he was motzi treifus mitachas yada, that now if he wants to do tshuva, he can be machshir himself the edus, and he can reinstate himself as a tabach. What is the way to do it? So in order to answer this question, the Gemara invokes a principle of Rabbi Idi Bar Ovin, the Omer of Idi Bar Ovin, hachoshen al atreifos, someone who in the past was machil trefos, he gave us non-kosher meat to eat, and now we suspect that he still is going to do the same thing. How do we trust him? Elo takana. And again, if we take a breath here and stop, we would assume that he has no takana. We can never reinstate him. We can never actually prove and demonstrate beyond the shadow of a doubt that he is a Baal Tshuva. But now we have to read the Sefer and let Rav Idi Bar Avin finish his statement, and he says, so we have to get him to prove that he's not putting on a facade. And how do we do that? He's going to have to relocate and find himself in an atmosphere, in a neighborhood where nobody knows him, and there he's going to do tshuva, and we're going to assume, as we'll explain, that his tshuva is actually sincere, that he's not trying to fool anyone, because there's no one here that he has to convince that he's a good guy. We have no reason in this new neighborhood to suspect. Again, you might wonder how he's going to pull this off, because we have so many ways of tracking a person down. A new man comes into town, he comes into Minyan. So what does he do? Does he change his name? He changes his passport? Can we not find out that he's a shochet from Yena Platz, from that old place where he did what he did with terrible things? But somehow he's able to conceal his identity, And in such a case, says Rav Idi, he is not a ma'ariv. Ma'ariv with an ayin. He's not someone who is fooling us. Now, what does he do in this new place that indicates that he doesn't love money? Because again, his tshuva to reinstate him as an aid kosher would mean that he's no longer suffering from the malady of chemdas mamon, which is a terrible disease that could bring a person to do all the averes in the Torah. So number one, the first alternative is yachzir aveda b'davar chashuv. Now again, exactly how you orchestrate this, we'll have to see. But he has to find a lost object that's worth a lot of money. And we'll soon see that the poskim say that the value of the money is all relative. If he's a poor guy, then even if it's not so expensive and precious, nevertheless it's considered davar chashuv. If he's a wealthy guy, which probably this fellow is, unless we've confiscated and frozen his assets, but then it'd have to be a diamond or a pearl necklace, you know, something that's really, really expensive. And anyone who loves mamon would certainly take this object and pocket it. I mean, one of the greatest yetzaharas in the world is when a person finds something of value and nobody would know the difference if he would just simply put it in his pocket, and that's the end of the story. And yet the Torah says he has to return this aveda. If a person returns this aveda, and it's a davar chashuv, then if we have reason to believe that he's not fooling anyone, he's doing this in all sincerity, that's a valid proof that demonstrates that he's a true baal tshuva. Now, if he would do the same thing locally, you know, in his state of nidui, of nivul, then again, we suspect, says Rava, that maybe he's just putting this on because he desperately wants to get reinstated, and therefore he's willing to part with an aveda, even though the aveda is worth something. But if he goes out to Yehupitz, you know, where nobody recognizes him, and he, you know, who would suspect that he's doing this? And why would we suspect that he's doing this in order to pull the wool over our eyes? Nobody here locally in this new place where he finds himself would even suspect that he is a tabach shehechilu v'hotzi trefos mitachas yado. So if in that place where he has no one to impress, he doesn't have to impress anyone, he's not trying to prove himself, and yet he returns an expensive object, he has proven that he has overcome the tremendous alluring power of the Yetzirah for chemdas mamon, for the love of money. And now the Gemara has another alternative. Oshi yotzi trefa mitachas yodo v'davar choshu mishalo, which means that he slaughtered an animal, and there's a very large animal that he slaughtered, it's worth a tremendous amount, and he admits that it's trefa. And he throws it into the rubbish pit. He has demonstrated that he's overcome chemdas mamon. Now here I have to read to you a few short comments. Excuse me, in the notes. Yeah. And then, you know what? Maybe I'll just read these comments, and then because I have a feeling it's going to address all your questions. Just very quickly. I'll do it very quickly. Number one. Based on Rashi, we conclude that there, in that new location where nobody recognizes him, nobody knows that he was removed from his original position, he doesn't feel compelled to demonstrate and prove that he did tshuva. And therefore, any tshuva that's real, that indicates that he is overcome his love for money, is a genuine tshuva. And to this comment, Rav Yaakov Emden adds the following. He says that what would be considered overcoming chemdas mamon, it's a relative concept. Meaning what's considered chemdas mamon, which would tempt you, is not necessarily what would tempt me. So if I'm a rich guy, I'm not tempted by a ring, even if that ring is worth $50. That's not tempting. But kol echad lefi ashro ulefi adiyuso ma choshev bi'eino. And then the Yad Ramah says that when he goes to another place and there he returns an aveda, he's not returning the aveda because he's embarrassed. and people might suspect that he's, you know, he's still chashed on Mammon, and therefore he went out of his way to prove that that, you know, to avoid this embarrassment, so he gave back the object, but rather he returns the object there in that makom because he was already poresh, he already overcame his chemdas mama. But if he doesn't go to another place, then it's possible that he did this hachzoras aveda in order to avoid embarrassment, because if he wouldn't return this aveda, people will still insist that he is suffering and he is over, he's subject to taivas chevdas chevdas bogol. And in the case of the second alternative, he shechts an animal and it turns out to be a treifa, it's got to be his animal. Right? Because take a look at the Gemara's language. It says, Mishalo. Mishalo means he owns the animal. You know, if he's just shechting on behalf of the community and he declares that this is a treifa, that doesn't really prove a thing, because he hasn't overcome his chemdas mammon. But if it's his own personal animal, and yet he's willing to say after the shechita that it's got to be thrown out because it's treif, he wasn't going to shecht on behalf of others who commissioned him, and that couldn't be possible either, because at this point no one's going to commission him to be a shochet. So the very fact that he shechted this animal means he shechted on his own behalf, and he's going to do tshuva, and he's going to take this very expensive animal and throw it out. And finally, the last comment that I want to add is the Nebuke Yosef, who writes that even if he goes to another location, and even if no one recognizes him in the other location, and even if he returns an aveda or he throws out the treifa that's tachas yado, he needs all three of them. Now the Nebuke Yosef has a different girsa, a different text of our Gemara. He leaves out the word o. So according to the Nebuke Yosef, I'm just mentioning this, this is not the way we have it in our text, but you should know about it. There are three conditions which Rav Idi Bar Oven sets, all of which have to be achieved in order to restore him as a tamach. Number one, he's got to go to a different location. Number two, there he has to return an aveda. And number three, he has to take a treifa mitachas yodo. The Nebuke Yosef rejects this because he says there's no reason why he should have to do all three. Any two out of the three, as long as he's in a location where we don't believe that he's trying to avoid the embarrassment, that he's trying to deliberately fool us. If we know he's genuine in a location where nobody recognizes him, then either Hachzoras Aveda or to be Motzi Treifa Mitachas Yado, that would be sufficient to demonstrate that he's a Baal Tshuva, he's genuine, and he has overcome his Taiva Smo.
Isn't it true that the Treifa meat was sold to non-Jews? I mean, he didn't have a total...
If he sold it exclusively to non-Jews, then that's fine.
In fact, the Torah, money on it, but because he sells the whole animal to a non-Jewish butcher.
Right. I think what the Gemara is describing is a marketplace where the Jews buy their meat, and that's where he marketed his meat.
Rabbi, is somebody monitoring that he's fulfilling these requirements?
Correct. That has to be proven. He's going to have to adduce witnesses that saw that he ended up in some location, nobody recognized him, and he returned the aveda, or he threw out the treifa.
Sounds like a rehabilitation program.
Interesting. I like that. You know, it's like sending a young person to reform school, you know, where he has to...
reform.
He has to reform. That's what we mean over here, yeah. Again, how is he going to get to that madrig? I don't know. You know, is it the fact that he's publicly humiliated because he lost his job, he lost his position, he lost his reputation, no one's going to trust his testimony? is that enough of a maka, you know, of a suffering that'll awaken him to do tshuva, like the shofar blows, you know, awakens us to do tshuva on Rosh Hashanah? Or is it perhaps that he undergoes some sort of a therapy? I don't know, maybe he has to see, you know, a psychologist who's going to deal with his issues about the love of money. Maybe he should go to his local rabbi, if his rabbi has that power to influence him and uplift him and inspire him, that when you get to the pearly gates, you're not going to take your money with you. You know, you have to have a clean reputation. And if somehow we could touch his heart, you know, especially in Hasidic literature, we consider a Jew to always have, no matter how far he strays, he has what's called a nekuda pnimis tahora, that even though he contaminates his whole body and his whole soul, but there's still one area within him that is untouched, unsoiled. It is not impacted and contaminated by sin. And that's the real belief or basis for tshuva. You know, when the Rambam says that the shofar is meant to waken up a person, it means to waken up that nekuda pnimis. You know, we lose contact. That pintalian, exactly. The nitzotz eloki, which is tahora, which remains pure and unadulterated, uncontaminated. It's a great preacher and a great baal mashpia who can take a person like this tamach, who should be publicly tarred and feathered. He's really, really guilty of chemdas mamon. And you can imagine the feeling of those who ate from his meat. I mean, just picture it. And normally in Beit Olam L'Chaver, you have to go around to the person and make sure you ask Mechila. He's not going to be able to do that. He doesn't know how many people or which people bought from his meat and ate his meat. And in that sense, it's very hard for him to do tshuva, but at least on a halachic level, he can push himself to the other extreme, in which he overcomes any temptation of chemdas mamon, and demonstrating that in these two ways that the Gemara specifies. And then by going to the other extreme, we assume that he is back on the right path, that we can reinstate him. You know, there'll always be some cynics who will not eat from his meat for the rest of his life. That's for sure. But halachic Jews believe in tshuva, and the halacha believes in tshuva. It's not an easy process, this process. First of all, he has to cleanse himself on a spiritual level and overcome this temptation of mammon, which is so powerful in his life. Then on top of that, he's got to, you know, find himself in gullus. I don't know if you've ever heard this phrase in Yiddish, prava gullus. In the old days, and for example, this goes back to the time of the Dubna Magid, and even before that, centuries ago, people, as part of the process of tshuva, used to prava gullus. They would go and relocate themselves sometimes for 6 months or even a year to a place where nobody knew them. So these were great people and reputations of great kavod in their local area. And in order to do tshuva, they would move into another neighborhood. And nobody would recognize them. There were all sorts of stories over the course of Jewish history about people who recognized them. There's always one Jew. He says, "Aren't you so and so? You know, I look below the beard and I can recognize you." But if everything is perfect, you know, your private goal is nobody. The Vilna Gaon himself, private goals. And when they asked him how many minutes of Bittul Torah he was guilty of, he took out his ledger and I think he came up with 6 minutes. There were 6 minutes during the entire year that he wasn't learning. You know, could you imagine such a thing? I mean, if we could do that in 1 hour, you know, say, let alone an entire year. Alright. Now, amongst the psulim which are enumerated in our Mishnah, one is called Mafriche Yonim. And the Gemara is going to present to Machlokes a great, great controversy as to what is Mafriche Yonim. What are they doing here? These are those who fly, you know, doves. They're dove flyers, so to speak. So my Mafriche Yonim, what are they? Who are these Mafriche Yonim? What are they guilty of? And why are they disqualified for testimony? So the Gemara says the following. Gemara says, Hacha, here at Bavel, Tirgama, they interpreted it as E takti me yonach liyon, if your dove will come in first. So they, you know, each person set up his yonah at a certain location, the starting point. You know, they shoot the gun and the race begins. And he says to his friend, if your yonah comes in first, I'll pay you such and such amount of money. And that's basically what we spoke about in terms of gambling. These pigeon races are another form of gambling. But Rabbi Chama bar Oshia Omar, he has a different take on Mafrikei Yonim, and he calls them Ara. Now the word Ara is an Aramaic word which means a decoy. So what happens is that you train a dove, and apparently if you're professional enough and the dove is intelligent enough, you're able to train him to attract others. And that yonah becomes a force to allure other yonim to follow. So what you do is, let's say you set up a trap. You send out this yonah, and all the birds from other people's coops start flocking towards your yonah, and little do they know that you're ready with your trap, and you're going to trap all these birds, and that's called gezel. That's you're stealing. Now again, we're going to have a long discussion about stealing. Is this really stealing? Maybe it's only a derabbanan. It's not a doraisa. So we're going to begin by mentioning the Rambam. The Rambam Shita here in our Mishnah, his Pirush HaMishnayos, is that he actually could send out one of two yonim. One is a male, and if he sends out the male will be able to entice other yonim that are nekevos, that are female, or he could send out a nekeva, and she will entice the males. The Yad Ramah says the following. What he does is he ties a rope, a very, very long, long rope around the yonah. At one end of the rope he has a piece of wood or something of weight so that the yonah will not be able to fly away. And then he sends the yonah up to his roof. And all the other yonim hear the voice of this yonah, and they are attracted to the voice of the yonah, and they show up on the roof. They can start flying in, and they gather, assemble from all different people's shovchim. Shovach is the coop, and they end up on the roof. He, the owner of this yonah, is waiting in ambush with a reshet, with a net, and he traps all the other yonim. So again, one opinion of Mafrikei Yonim, that's the first opinion of the Gemara, that's Bavel, the Babylonians, they interpreted the Mishnah as referring to races. And these are basically gambles, that people would gamble on who would win the race. Today it's more common to have horse racing, but back in the day they had dove racing. And Rabbi Bar Oshia has an alternative interpretation. He's not willing to accept, and the Gemara's going to ask why, that we're talking about a gambler. You can already guess the Gemara's answer, because it says gambling in the beginning of the Mishnah, which is called Mesachek Bekuvia. Why would you have to add Mafrikei Yonah, which is just another example of gambling? But rather, we're talking about a person who is actually stealing other people's birds by using this yonah as an ara. Again, this yonah was well trained in figuring out exactly how it would entice other yonim to join her or him. and then the owner of this Yona was waiting in ambush and would trap and steal other people's birds. So in a sense, you could say that this Yona that's called an Ara is the opposite of a scarecrow. You remember the scarecrow? Which is made to scatter the animals, right? To larchikotam. Here, on the contrary, the Yona is there lekarev osam, to bring them closer. Now in the back of the Gemara, we have a commentary called the Rashash. He lived about 150 years ago, a little bit less. And he asks the following question. If we go with the first opinion of the Babylonians, that Matriche Yonim are those who say that if your Yona comes in first, I'll pay you, then we begin to understand that there may be Gezel over here, and then we have to ask ourselves the question, why did the Tana have to teach us both Mesachik Bekubio, which might be Gezel, and Mafriche Yonim, which is also a case of Gezel? And not only that, the Mishnah already mentioned Malve Beribis, and Malve Beribis is someone who violates the Torah law for the sake of money. And if Mafriche Yonim, no less than Mesachik Bekubio, by gambling, is stealing money, then for sure he would be possibly Amos. So why did the Tanav HaMishnah bother with Mafriche Yonim according to the Babylonians, when it's basically a repeat of what we know about Mesachik Bekubio, that the gambler is a Gazlan or Ka'ed Gazlan? So one of the super commentaries on the Mishnah is called the Teferes Yisrael, otherwise known as the Yochanu Boaz. Anyway, he writes that the reason why the Tana had to tell us all these cases is to tell us that there's such a thing called a Psul Derabanan. Now, if he had only told us the cases, or shall I say the case of a gambler, of a Mesachik Bekubio, I would not have yet known that there's such a thing as a Psul Derabanan. But when we add Mafriche Yonim to the list, then we must conclude with all certainty that we're dealing with a Psul Derabanan. And we'll try to explain why. So now, before we explain why, let's explain the Teferes Yisrael. The Teferes Yisrael said that it was critical to inject Mafriche Yonim into the picture so that we appreciate that Malve Beribis could be a Psul Derabanan. And why is that a Psul Derabanan? And the answer is, we're going to base ourselves on Rava, who says that Malve Beribis is not just whom? The Malve could also be the
Lover.
The Lover. Now, in the case of the Lover, he's not stealing anything. He's not illegally misappropriating someone else's mamon. On the contrary, he's paying ribis. So the classification of the Lover as an aid apostle, as disqualified, could only be derabanan. But the Mishnah says Malva Beribis. So if we only had the Mishnah, how would I know that there's such an entity, or such an institution in Halacha called a Psul Derabanan? Says it to Teferes Yisrael, that's why the Mishnah had to indicate Mafriche Yonim. That although Mesachik Bekubio might be a Psul Doraisa, and we're going according to Rabbi Bar Chama, who says that there's a kind of exalia because Asmachta Lo Kanya, so that could be Ke'ed Gzela Doraisa, but the case of Mafriche Yonim is clearly Derabanan. Now you have to write yourself down a note, why is Mafriche Yonim clearly, why does it max out as a Psul Derabanan? And in order to answer that question, we have to read another few lines in the Gemara. The Gemara says the following: how do we analyze this machlokus between the Bavliim who identify Bafriche Yodim as gamblers and Rabbi Chama Bar Oshia, who refuses to accept that interpretation of the Bavliim and substitutes the Ara? Mandi Omer, says the Gemara, according to the Mandi Omer, who says that we're talking about gambling, we're talking about dove racing, Itak Debe Yonach Leon. I'm going to pay you if your Yonah comes before mine, comes in first. My time below Omar Ara. What was his problem? Why did he object to Rabbi Chama's interpretation that we talk about a Yonah that brings in other Yonim from the various Shovchim of the of other neighboring neighbors, and there's a violation here of Gezel? Omalacha, the reason is because Ara is Mipnei Darkei Shalom B'Alma. Wow. This is a radical change in our understanding of the sugya of Mafriche Yona. And the Gemara is not here. The Gemara is only sort of hinting at another sugya. The main sugya is in Bav Metzia, on Daf Kuf Beis. And the Gemara says that the reason why there is a problem here of Ara, of this alluring other birds, which you're going to capture, is because of Darkei Shalom. What does this mean, Darkei Shalom, the ways of pleasantness, of peace? This is based on another sugya in Masechta Gittin Daf Nun Tes, and the Gemara there, the Mishnah actually, establishes there in Gittin that there are two categories of Gezel. There's Gezel min HaTorah, if I steal something of yours. And then there's something called Gezel mipnei Darkei Shalom, which means that technically the object is not yours, but the Rabbanan are going to make it as if it's yours. They're going to prohibit Gzela for anyone else to take it in order to avoid dispute and altercations and friction. In order to guarantee harmony and peace, they're going to make it as if it's yours. For example, in the case of Yodei Shovach, what happens is that birds that belong to the skies, there nobody owns them, fly in and out of a Shovach. In such a case, there's no kinyan on behalf of the owner of the Shovach. In other words, the halacha is not going to assume that, at least on a Doraisa level, that any bird that's found inside a coop belongs to the owner of the coop. Why? Because the birds fly in and they fly out. They're never actually trapped in the coop. If they were trapped in the coop, then there's something called Chatzero Shal Adam Kodalo Shalomidato, that if a person owns a Chatzer, which is any sort of enclosed vehicle or receptacle, and it's protected and it's not moving, it's stationary, then if Hefker, something that's odorless, ends up inside his Chatzer, then his Chatzer will be Koda on his behalf. And the Gemara has a whole discussion whether it's Chatzer Mishum Yad, Chatzer Mishum Shlichus, but whatever it is, Chatzer is Koda. However, that's only when the object goes into a place which is protected. It has Shmira. And the object is now caught, so to speak. It's jailed, it's incarcerated within an area. That's considered Chatzer. But if it goes in and out, so flies in through one window and flies out the other window, then he's not Koda Midin Chatzer. Until the Chachamim instituted an enactment which is called Gezel Mipnei Darkei Shalom. It means that the Chachamim are going to recognize ownership where the Torah does not. And what motivates the Chacham to do so is because of Darkei Shalom. Imagine what anarchy would go on if I could enter into your shovach, pull out a bird, and say it's mine because you never made a kinyan on it. The bird went in and the bird went out. Now, obviously, there's a certain number of birds that are trained to stay in the coop. You know, these are my birds that I made a kinyan on. But now, there are other birds that flock into your chicken coop. You know, you have this, let's say, for birds, they have a kind of a cage. Have you ever seen it? And it goes into the cage, and now I'm going to enter into your cage, and I'm going to start cleaning out all your birds. So the Rabbanan had to make a valid kinyan, which on a Torah level is not a valid kinyan. That's called Gezel B'nei Darkei Sholom. I'll give you another example. Let's say my son is 7 years old, and he goes ahead and finds some sort of lost object, which is Hefker, and he picks it up. On a Doraisa level, his Agbah is not a valid Kinyan. Why? Because he's a Katan. But the Rabbanan are going to say if somebody grabs it away from the Katan, that's going to be a violation of Gezel Mishum Darkei Sholom. There's going to be absolute disputes and fights, because anytime I see your son who's a katan grabbing something, I'm going to grab it away from him because the Torah says it's not his. Same thing applies to a cheresh and so forth and so on. So the ownership of the birds in the coop that are now being allured by, let's say, Reuven, who owns this ara, is only a rabbinic ownership. I'm thinking out loud here, I don't want to confuse you, but let's say, for example, a bird flies into my coop. If I were to sell it to you, then on a Torah level, it would not be a sale because I don't own it. I never made a kinyan chatzar. It's going in and out. Let's say I would give it to a woman and say, I react mekudeshesli biyona zoo. Would that be valid kedusha? So then you have to know whether Rabbanan established this new ownership, this new category of Gezel Mishbei Daki Shalom. Is that something that the Torah would recognize? And at the surface of it, ostensibly I would say no, because on the Torah level he doesn't own it. So it's really interesting when Ploni, I don't know, whatever name you want to give him, sets up this Yona, which is called an Ara, and he causes all the Yonim to come flock on the top of his roof, and then he nets them and he captures them. On a Doraisa level, he has not violated the Isur Gezel. Because the Gemara says that this Gezel is only Midin Mipnei Darkei Sholom. And therefore, would that Gezel be considered Gezel? And the Nafkamina here in our Sugya Sanhedrin is whether or not that person who owns the Ara is Pasulievus. If we say that Darkei Sholom is just a Mida Tova, you know, it's very nice, you know, you shouldn't take things away from other people, even if technically they don't own them, because that's going to violate that's going to generate a certain enmity, then it's not really stealing. You know, tell him that he doesn't deserve Shishi because he's not a Balbidus. You know, why did he create all this friction and tension? But to say that he's a Gazlan, I wouldn't say he's a Gazlan. He didn't steal anything because these birds are not owned, technically, according to the Torah law, by the Bali HaShvachos. Or we could say no. And this is going to be the view of Rabbi Chava. That even though in the case of Ara, we're dealing with a Gezel Midivrei Chachamim Mipnei Darkei Sholom, nevertheless that also is considered Gezel. So if we take Rabbi Bar Chama, I'm sorry, Rabbi, what was his name? Rabbi Bar Oshia, and we understand that according to his interpretation of Mafriche Yona, we're not dealing with a high level Psul Gezel Doraisa, but he's possibly Amos Min Rabbanon because of Darkei Sholom, that kind of Gezel. Then we understand what the Rashash was pointing out here, that the Mishnah wanted to take us from Mesachik Bekubia to Mafriche Yona, because Mafriche Yona is only a psul derabbanon. It's not really gzeil on a doraisa level. He's not stealing anything because there's no ownership. There's no chatzer. These are birds of hefker. But the Rabbanon instituted me, Darkei Sholom, it's gezel. And if you look carefully at the Gemara, The Gemara just says, Mipnei Darkei Shalom. I would add one word to the Gemara, at least according to Rabbi Chama, Bar Oshia, and that is Gezel Mipnei Darkei Shalom. This is Gezel. And therefore, he's Pasul Yedus as a Gazlon Dirabon. All this is to explain the Shita of Rabbi Chama. The first sheet of the Bavliyim, they rejected this. It can't be that Mafriche Yona is referring to those who entice other birds and steal those birds, because that's not called stealing. That's only Darkei Shalom. But there's no violation of Gezel in any sense, not even on the Darabonah level. Therefore, that would not generate a Psul Edus. Ubandi Omar Ora. Why did Rabbi Chama reject the possibility that we're talking about dove racing? My time below Omar Itakhtime Yonach Liyon. Omar Lecha. So Rabbi Chama was upset because Haidu Mesachek Bekubia. Then the Mishnah is just reiterating what we already know, that gambling, in this case dove racing, generates a psul yedus, and there's no justification for the Mishnah repeating itself if it's already told this in the Sachik Bekubia. And now I think we're up to the word ve'idach. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to shift to this Gemara. Sorry, I had a photocopy that I was using. Ve'idach, and if you assume that Mafrichi Yonah is referring to gambling, why would the Mishnah go out of its way to repeat itself twice? Tana Tolev Das Atzma V'Tanav Tolev Das Yonah. In other words, in the case of Mesachik Bekubia, the reason why he is a Gazlon is because Asmachta Lo Kanya, what makes it into an Asmachta when he enters into this gambling match? He's Tolev Das Atzma. He's a big shot. He thinks that he's going to win the poker game. So he really never sincerely, with a full-fledged Gemir Stas, committed himself to pay, assuming he would lose. I'm not a loser. I'm a winner. So that's a case of Asmachta. But what about a case where it's totally out of his hands? For example, it all depends on the Yonah. If the Yonah is going to run fast and win the race, is Tana Tolev Das Yonah. And even in this case, where you would say he made an absolute commitment, because he knew statistically there's no guarantee that he would win this race, because it all depends on the Das Yonah, nevertheless, that's called a Smachta, and he's considered a violator of Ke'ed Gzela, and he's Posel Yedus. Perhaps what the Gemara is telling us is that in the case of Mafriche Yonim, which means that we're talking about a race according to the Bavliyim, here he has trained his Yonah. He has made this Yonah into the fastest flying dove on the face of the earth. I don't know if you remember reading children's books to your children or grandchildren. Who remembers Berenstein's Bears? Classic, right? So Papa Bear is absolutely convinced that no Yonah on the face of the earth is going to fly faster than his Yonah, because he has trained this Yonah. So he believes that he's going to win, and therefore there's an Asmachta problem over here, and there's a Ke'en Gzela. Utsricha, the Gemara says, and with this we'll wrap it up. De'itana Tola V'das Atzmo. If the Mishnah had only mentioned the case of Mesachik Bekubia, where he thinks he's a great gambler, Hasam there, who de lo gomer amakne, he relies on himself totally, lives in this fantasy world, as Rashi says, in Ba'olam She'eno, and he thinks he's going to win. He never really made a sincere commitment to pay. The Omar, and here we're turning to Daf Chav Hei Omid Beis, Kivli B'Daf Shoi, the Adana Tfei. I know better how to win this game than my friend, and I'm certainly going to win. I won't have to pay him a dime. And therefore, he never had a Gemir Stas that he would pay. His opponent came to the exact same conclusion. He thinks he's the greatest poker player. And he never had in mind that he would lose. That's already Kaid Zela, that's a smachta. But Aval Tolib Das Yono, where it's completely out of his hands, it all depends upon the Yono, if the Yono's in the mood to fly fast, is able lo. Maybe in such a case, this is not called an asmachta, and he made an absolute commitment that he would pay if in event that his Yona comes in second instead of first. And therefore there's no chashash gzeilis koshal yedus. But what about the other way around? The itana, if it would have only had the case of mafriche yonim, which is called tolo b'das yono, then I would have said that the omer b'naksha talya milsa. Nakosha means when you bang something. In this case, you bang with wood. And the balei yonim, the owners of these doves, they know exactly how to take these flat luchos, they're called, you know, tablets of wood, and they bang together in such a way that the yonim hear this loud noise, and they recognize that specific noise, and it's coming from their balim. And they run fast, and they fly as fast as you can. Is Anoya Danil in a Kushe Tfe? I'm better at this, I'm more of an expert than my competitor, and therefore for sure, my Yoda is going to come in first. I'm the greatest Baal Nakushe. I have, me and my favorite dove have a very good relationship, and we've trained this dove to recognize my nikushim when I bang with these pieces of wood, and I have no doubt that I'm going to win this race, that my dove is going to come in first. In such a case, he is guilty of asmachta, and asmachta lokanya, he's ke'ed gazla. Aval tolo b'das atzmo, in a case where he accepts upon himself to pay, where he's completely out of control, able low. In other words, he's saying whatever the outcome will be, fate will determine whether I win this poker game or I won't win this poker game. In such cases, no chisaron of asmachta. He had an absolute commitment to pay in event that he loses. He never knew for sure that he would win. It was always in his mind, the safek tzricha. I still need the chiddush of the Mishnah. That even in that case of Tola B'das Atzmo, in the case of Mesachik B'Kubya, it is an Asmachta, it is Kei Gzela, and therefore he's Pasul Yehus. Okay, Rav Moses, let's just make a note of where we got up to here, thank you. And we're up to Beis Vei. On Daf Chof Hei, Amin Beis. Okay then, I want to wish everyone a great day, and thank you.